So, who are you, and why are you here?
Don't worry, I'm not going to get all navel-gazy on you. We're talking about your business, your brand. Have you built a brand that attracts the people that you actually want to work with? You want to know how you get it done? Well, we have a brand architect on deck today, and we're going to find out just what that is a little later on Embark. Hi, I'm Liz Solar, and I'd like to introduce you to the incredible Orlie Ziwi, brand architect and author of the book, Ready, Launch, Brand, the Lean Marketing Guide for Startups, published by Routledge Press, available on Amazon. Hey, Orlie, it's a pleasure to see your face. I wish everyone could see our faces, but it's not that type of show, right?
Right. Yes, thank you. Thank you, Liz, likewise.
So, tell me what's new with you. I know back in May you birthed something, or perhaps it just felt like going through childbirth.
Birth is probably a good way, but it took longer than birthing my two children. That was only 9 months apiece. This took 5 years. So this is my first book, and my book is called Ready, Launch, Brand, the Lean Marketing Guide for Startups. And it's available on Amazon, and it was published by Routledge, and it came out in May of 2021, so just very recently. And in April, it was noted as the number one new business book release on Amazon.
Orlie, I know both of our lives involve a lot of writing, highly verbal life. And to be able to write a book, I mean, that's an achievement in itself. But to get it out there into the world, have it published, kudos to you.
I have to say that right about the beginning of 2020, I thought, I'm never going to finish this book. And I was lucky enough to connect with a fabulous editor who was able to basically get me across the finish line.
It's similar to working out, ramping up for, you know, the triathlon or a marathon where you have somebody right behind you saying, hey, you can do this, and have you keep your head in the game or get you over the finishing line. I don't know. The sports metaphors seem to come easy to me.
Pretty much. And I have to say, you know, what was really great, it's like it was mostly like coming up with like sort of the beginning, the end, and then just tweaking things along the way and kind of getting the voice, you know, and I know you'll appreciate this being a voice coach yourself, is, you know, it takes a really skilled editor to pull out the voice of the writer.
Absolutely, Orlie. I know an author who was trying to get the right voice for a character. She was writing historical fiction, and the main character was someone who's well known. She said she spent a year trying to figure out what this person sounded like. And from that voice came the rest of the story, the backstory, the subtext. She was able to work out plot points based on what that person sounded like. I just want to acknowledge you've received some incredible accolades for your book. And without sounding a little cheeky, branding and marketing, those books, I mean, there's a bunch of them out there. They're a dime a dozen. So when someone high profile gives you praise, I have to sit up and take notice. Notably, it was Seth Godin who said that your book is a powerful and urgent introduction to lean marketing and the magic of getting it right. And I think getting it right, doing what you do as well as you do, seems so simple. It seems like anybody should be able to do it, but the execution, so much harder.
Yeah, it was not easy, just so you know. I think part of the, I wouldn't say it's a struggle. I mean, you know, looking, you know, of course, looking back, it seems like, you know, you can kind of laugh about some of this stuff. But I think that what really struck me is how long it took even for the idea to gel, you know, because in the beginning, it was going to be a very different book. And then I went back to school and got an MBA, and that's really where the idea for the book as it now stands came from. This idea that it all couldn't come from me, that I needed to talk to real entrepreneurs about their marketing stories. Once I kind of moved into that direction, then the book really took off for me.
So what was the timeline between getting your MBA and figuring out what this book would be all about?
So I went back to school in 2002. I graduated in 2014, and I officially started, and by the way, I had a different title. It was, you know, how these things are. And it was actually my editor, Lewis, who said to me, "Why are you using this title?" I had already launched Brent. I mean, I literally had that as one of the options. He said, "Why aren't you using that? That's such a perfect title for this." So I had to, you know, I had to agree with him that really was a better one than False Starts, which was the one that I had started with. That was not the title that it ended up being. It didn't have kind of the energy that Ready Launch Brand feels like. Okay, start my engines.
You know, Ready Launch Brand, those are all action words. There's momentum. And when people hear a verb, when they have a directive to action, they take action.
Yeah. And it's interesting because the moment I kind of reframed the book using that title, it all started to fall into place. So the title really, I think, got me stuck thinking, because False Starts actually came from one of the interviews. And, you know, one of my interviewees, one of the founders that I interviewed, said to me, you know, we just kept having all these false starts because we hadn't taken the time, right? And I thought, oh, you know, but it ended up that this was much better as a call to action. So now the both the beginning and the end, you know, kind of play on that, you know, so now Ready, Launch, Brand, let's do it, right? So that's kind of how the book ends.
You know, in the parlance of my Italian forebears and other paisans, andiamo, let's go.
Andiamo, yeah, I got it.
But since you do have this wonderful introduction to lean marketing, I do have to ask, what is lean marketing? And why do I need to know about it?
Great question, Liz. So most people, when they think of marketing, think a spot on the Super Bowl. They think direct mail. They think radio spots. They think TV spots in general. They think expensive. And the problem when you're a startup is you don't have money. And also you have no recognition. So even if you had the money, it wouldn't work because people have never heard of you. So your goal, and this is kind of a core principle of lean marketing, is your job as a startup is to build brand awareness. So to do that and to do it well, you need to clarify who you are as a brand, who you want to invite into your conversation, and then develop the kind of connect the two, align your kind of your brand, your vision, your core value, your value prop, your unique value proposition, right? Your UVP. You want to align that with who that customer is, and especially figure out what really matters to them. So as a startup, as any company, your job is that you are solving either a pain or fulfilling a need. Those are the two key things. And as a startup, to build brand awareness, you need to very quickly establish that your solution, the way you're going about whatever it is that you're doing, is solving a real need or a pain point that's being relieving a pain point. That's a true pain point, not just one that, you know, you kind of think would be that way. And so one of the things I talk about in the book is that you want to make sure that you talk to your customers, and you need to, because otherwise you're just a solution looking for a problem.
Exactly. And from what I've seen you write and heard you talk about, it's not enough to solve a problem. You need to find your ideal client, and whether you are a brand architect or a voice actor or a cellist, we need to figure out who that person is that we're talking to and relate to them and resist the impulse to try to reach out to everybody, because not everybody is our audience.
Yes. In fact, that's another key concept in the book that, you know, if you're talking to everyone, you're really talking to no one. I think it was trying to think of who the writer was who said this, that if I had more time, I'd write a shorter letter.
That would be Mark Twain.
And so, you know, the idea is that, you know, in a way, it's much easier to put a lot of information out there. I mean, anyone can really do that. What I have found is that it's really about putting out just enough information so that you are piquing someone's curiosity And they want to know more. That's kind of, you know, when I give my elevator pitch, you know, and this is another thing I teach about this. I do workshops on this around how to really craft an elevator pitch that's not a sales pitch. You're not trying to sell me. You're trying to give me just enough so I know if I'm your ideal client. The best thing about an elevator pitch is when someone, you get that deer in headlight look, you know, that's a gift, honest to God. That is a gift because when someone doesn't get it, what a gift it is that I can just walk away because I've just saved myself months of trying to convince someone to buy something that they have no interest in and don't get, don't value, don't want, don't need, or what, you know, whatever the reason is.
So Orly, in all of your experience working directly with clients or, you know, in your observations, how much time does the average business owner, founder, entrepreneur spend on trying to figure out who, you know, who their clients are and how many are looking for why things aren't working and then in turn try to remediate those things?
Well, I'll tell you the truth. What typically happens is someone will come to me and I've had, you know, I don't only work with startups, but I, you know, now I've sort of, you know, really created that niche. But what I found is it takes 1 to 3 years before somebody says, we have a problem. Because by year 1 to 3, and it, honest to gosh, it's really like I can almost put the clock on it. Because if you don't do any marketing, and this is really the thing that my book talks about, is we need to stop thinking of traditional marketing as something we aspire to and instead use the principles of lean marketing, which is around clarity, which is around using social media. By the way, using one, not 10, not 20 different sites, one, and developing content on the site that your customers go to. So again, it's all about clarifying who you are, clarifying who they are, clarifying your message, and then finding the venues to kind of put those messages out. And the thing that I always find so interesting is, you know, people try it every which way. And what happens is by year one, between 1 to 3, I'm sorry, what am I saying? No, it's not 1 to 3, 3 to 5. Sorry, because I want to get to them in the year 1 to 2. So 3 to 5. Sorry about that. So in year 3 to 5, what happens is nobody knows who you are. Your salespeople are literally wasting a lot of time just trying to get people to understand what you do, which means that they can't cross sell. And it means that you're also getting the wrong clients, because a lot of times what people will do, when you do generic messaging, anyone is a potential client. And so what happens is these different people who come into your brand end up basically defining who you are as a business, because you're constantly shifting, right? So this clarity also allows you to build your business on a true brand. And then by 3 years, 3 to 5, you should have doubled your business easily. You should be scaling, right? So my goal is to get people to do all this at the beginning so they don't have to wait till year 3 to say, oh my gosh. Because, you know, the moment you hire a salesperson, first thing that salesperson is going to say is, well, what do we do? You know, what do I talk about? How do I sell this?
So when I was reading a little bit about lean marketing, it seems as if, you know, you're putting together this marketing plan, and along the way, there may be some changes that you make. Your business is evolving. Perhaps you are evolving. Your message evolves. And that could be over a couple of years' time. There are benefits to that because you're always refining your message. What are the dangers of that, though? Because it's almost like editing as you write. You're kind of taking yourself out of your own process. And I think the other part is that you could be talking about something today that things change so quickly. So how do you keep up and how do you sound current and of the moment and still remain consistent?
What I'm going to say here is yes, and the thing that should never change is your core value. I give the example of Nordstrom's. You know, we're all familiar with Nordstrom's. Their core value is customer service. One of the stories that I share in the book is somebody who came in, and I can't remember now where the store was, but it used to be a tire store, and then it got transformed, right? But one day, literally, somebody came in rolling in 2 tires in the middle of the store, and the person who helped them took them back, no receipt, no questions asked. That's customer service. So if your customer service looks like that, That's your core value. But what people tend to do is they use words like customer service and responsive and, you know, friendly, or, you know, all kinds of words that are really just words, but there's nothing to back them up, which is why I also say in my book that you should really only have one core value, because that's the value you adhere to and would adhere to, even if it was illegal to do so.
Wow. We don't want to promote any criminal activity or get anybody in trouble with the law here. How does a core value differ from your mission? Because we see all of that on people's websites, which is how we find so many of those people. We find those keywords or, you know, those values that we might be looking for.
Right. So the mission, well, you know, typically mission statements are for nonprofits because they have a board of directors, and they need to have a fairly, you know, well articulated mission that, but the mission is based on the core value. I'll give you an example. So I recently worked with a national nonprofit who had been messaging all around education, which made sense because they literally covered K through college and beyond. I mean, that was kind of their whole modus operandi, was around education. But after I did a brand tune-up with, it was 25 employees, including the executive director. And what I discovered from these exercises that, by the way, are in the book, the exercise that really helped them clarify who they were, it turned out that they were really a community activist who used education to change communities and change the world.
Now, did they not know that, or did they know that but just not find the language?
They did not know that. Again, it's this idea, like I was saying before, being a solution looking for a problem. And the way that shows up, by the way, on your website is because they had all these different verticals of education, it was just redundancy everywhere. By simplifying the message, you know, then they could just have the homepage could just talk about that. And then these educational outlets really became part of, they became brand extensions. But it was like, if think about it like a wheel, and these were the spokes, versus having every educational platform. Like, so if you're doing a pre-K, that's got its own messaging, but really it's all part of the same message. It's still part of the brand, being a community activist who's using education to empower communities.
I'm a bit of a minimalist, so when I see all that information, I just glaze over. Unless there's some compelling content, some links to articles that may be of interest, some quotes that resonate, so much of it feels like a waste of time and, quite frankly, a lot of noise.
You know, I talk a lot about, I've been using this tagline, you know, cutting through the noise. I've been saying that for 20 years. Now people are starting to say it. But I've literally been saying that for 20 years. And I will tell you that cutting through the noise is at the end of the day, that's really what I help my clients do. Cut through the noise, but with content that's easy to find, easy to understand, easy to execute on. And at the end of the day, it's really about finding me quickly, understanding what I do quickly, because when I land on a homepage, you've got 6 seconds to convince me to stay or go. And if you don't convince me to dig deeper, and by the way, people often misinterpret this idea of clicking as somehow being a bad thing. That is actually not true. You want to encourage people to click, but they also need to be able to find something valuable within 3 clicks or they're also gone.
Then you're a true service provider, Orly, because you're giving people information above and beyond. It might be, hey, this is what I offer, but you might want to check out this person as well. We can't do all of the work. So if it's a colleague that we can refer people to, or it's a related resource, that's the real value add.
I agree with you, Liz. The problem is that so many people, they have this, and it's a really interesting phenomena that I've observed over the last 20 years and also during these interviews, is that people think that they're going to leave something out and that means that people aren't going to read. So instead of helping me kind of actually create a user's journey that allows me to learn, because as we know, learning anything new, you can't like tell me everything up front because I'm just not going to hear it. And I'm going to be so overwhelmed, I'm going to shut down. And to your earlier point, if you have a lot of content, and this is, I see this all the time with homepages. You know, homepages have only one purpose, to answer two questions. Why am I here and why should I care? That is it. Instead, what people do is they load all this stuff onto their homepage. Oh, we are a great company. We've been voted, whatever. Nobody cares about that at that moment. It's not to say that you shouldn't have it on there. Think of the homepage as the front door to your brand. And, you know, no one would ever think, unless you're a hoarder, no one would ever think it was okay to put the contents of your bedroom, your closets, your kitchen appliances, every piece of clothing that you own, put that all in at your front door, right? People wouldn't do that. But honestly, I see homepages all the time that do exactly that. And I do this for a living, and I will literally look through somebody's website and I have no idea what they do.
Which is difficult. I mean, it's the catch-22 because they want to be found and they're not giving the information that helps them to be found. And that's also compounded with. So let's use you as an example. For years, perhaps decades, you know, one of your things is you tell people you help them cut through the noise. Now, in the last couple of years, so many people are going to help you cut through the noise or be more authentic. And those phrases are ubiquitous, so it starts to feel a little bit disingenuous. Now, you're killing me with this. You know, when we go to these sites, or, you know, we may be guilty ourselves of having the same wording, the same values, even the same look. How do we differentiate ourselves? We want our words and ideas to be exact and on point and be specific. And at the same time, we need the language to be able to separate ourselves from the pack.
Well, and it's not just that. I mean, if we're just talking about websites, when I started writing the book, there were roughly 1.7 billion websites in the world. And then now they're close to 2 billion. What's interesting to note is that most of them get no visitors, literally. So you're talking about 0.01% of those websites get 50% of all traffic. Think Google, think Facebook, you know, the usual suspects. And the problem is that, you know, we as humans are creating content at such a rapid rate and at such large numbers that it's not even the content that's coming from other places. It's our own content. It's what we're uploading, what we're curating. I mean, Twitter now, it's 6,000 tweets per second are uploaded. So every time you refresh your Twitter feed, another 6,000, another 6,000. I mean, you know, it's a little bit mind-boggling, right, when you think about all that. And so add to that the lack of any kind of focus or any kind of really, without any clarity, it's just a bunch of noise. So you have to, you know, if you're lucky enough to, and again, I'm not talking about what the strategy is to get people onto your website. That's a whole other conversation, right? I mean, my book is really dealing with kind of that first step, because without that first step, you cannot build a marketing strategy, because marketing is about sales. And it is actually the engine that starts your sales. And if you don't know what you're selling, which is the brand component, it becomes impossible to convince someone to buy something that you yourself don't understand.
So you don't know who you are. You don't know who you're selling. It gets really hard to give that message to someone and have them feel welcome or compelled to join you in whatever it is you're doing, let alone find you.
And then there's the other piece, which is people, there's all, you know, my book has also all these myths, you know, that I'm hoping to really break. And one of them is, you know, well, marketing is smoke and mirrors anyway, because people don't really understand it's what it does. And so because people don't, you know, all they can think about is what they have seen on television or on YouTube or whatever, those big ad campaigns, which are fine for large brands like Nike, who spends, by the way, they spend about $190 million a year on marketing, which is roughly 10% of their sales, which, by the way, is the industry standard of how much you should be spending of your gross, 10% of your gross. And every startup founder I've ever talked to has never spent 10%. And yet they will spend that easily on IT, on legal, on, you know, other things, right? But marketing is the engine of everything. And yet they completely forget. And lo and behold, they wait 3 to 5 years And that's the whole connection between 3 to 5 years and all of a sudden we don't know who we are.
Now, most of your work is with startups, but how many people that you work with are either mid-career or are continuing to build something that they have had over years and decades?
Well, then you have to add this other thing, which is the future of work, which, of course, is already here. And all these jobs that are going to be upended. And we're, you know, the latest stats that I just saw, you know, if you're 18 to 40 right now, you're going to have roughly 12 careers in your lifetime. And I think about, I mean, I have literally reinvented myself probably half a dozen times since I started just going into design in general and communications. And so I probably have already had 12 different careers, come to think of it. But what's interesting is people will have to reinvent themselves. Now, imagine how hard it is. And I also do LinkedIn profiles. In fact, I'm working with somebody now to really help them to reimagine kind of how to integrate the skills they have into a new career, into a new focus. And think how difficult that is if you haven't taken the time to first understand who you are, right? So to me, you know, again, it's like going down a stream and trying to figure out where the source is. That's kind of what I've been doing my whole career. And what I realize is it all starts there. So if you can get that kind of clarity and you can get your message to be on brand, and you really understand what's keeping your client up at night. It also means, by the way, that you may have to pivot. You may have to change. And people don't like that, right? People don't really want to change. So we're back to being a solution looking for a problem. And one of the things I talk about in my book, I give this example of bubble wrap. I don't know how much you know about the history of bubble wrap.
That would be nothing.
Nothing. Well, that's because everyone's forgotten this part because it was just so ridiculous. People who came up with this idea, they were coming up with it as a decoration idea for people's walls, as wallpaper. Needless to say, it didn't go well. But what's interesting about the story is that what they discovered when they went out and they realized, you know, and I call it, you know, discovering you have an ugly baby. You know, I talk a little bit about, you know, not being afraid to have somebody call your baby ugly. And so what happened is that they realized they had a great product, but it was solving the wrong problem.
I mean, I think it's great for stress relief.
Well, that's a whole other, right? But yeah, but it turned out that there was nothing that really kept your belongings safe in travel. Like before bubble wrap, what do you use? Newspapers, right? And so bubble wrap is fabulous. But again, it's you need to know who you are. You need to know who you serve, and you need to know the real pain. So as soon as they realized that they'd literally birthed an ugly baby, they went back to the drawing board and they thought about, well, where else could they use this, right? And actually, the way they developed it is really fascinating. They actually put together two pieces of plastic and they kind of did this thing where they created bubbles. And that's where the idea for bubble wrap came from.
I work in a padded room, as you can see. It's never occurred to me to put bubble wrap up. I'm thinking about it now. And it's a good time to be bubble wrap because you cannot find a newspaper these days to wrap all of those delicate, fragile items when you're moving.
No, you cannot, because they're pretty much going by the way of the dodo bird. Yeah, that's true. But the thing, I guess, you know, I always come back, for me, it's always coming back to why am I here? What, you know, what's my why? I know you're familiar with Simon Sinek. He actually came and spoke to our cohort when I was in school, and he was just starting, you know, he had just started, I think, his golden circle, which I refer to in the book. You know, I think he came up with that in, like, I can't remember, maybe 2009 or something like that. Anyway, it was the second most watched video, YouTube video of all time. That video is literally what helped me understand what I wanted to do. And that is what I do. I help founders figure out their why.
Orly, now, when you talk about yourself, you say you're a brand architect. How do you differentiate yourself using those words, brand architect, from the many people who are brand consultants or marketing people, marketing messages people? There are many good ones. There are some not so good ones, as in any field. But there are a lot of people out there who are needing the help of somebody to brand their business. and why you?
Well, you know, I call myself a brand architect because I build the DNA of startup brands. And other brand consultants, and I could have easily called myself a brand consultant, because the reason is because I look at the whole entity. I look at what is your business model? Why did you start? What's your vision? What's your mission? What's the core value? I look at, you know, kind of, if you think about a brand like a house, I look at the foundation. That's my goal, is to make sure the foundation is solid. And then, you know, I help you build the frame and help you figure out style the rooms, you know, what style the outside should be as well. All right. So it's kind of a blueprint. So I like the architect. It's this idea that you cannot build anything unless you have a solid foundation. And, you know, you want to make sure the doors are in the right place and the stairs are to code. You know, it's all of that. So in a way, you know, what I help founders do is really look at what have we built? Does it fit with who we are? And then the other piece, which I also talk about in my book, which is making sure that we're being clear about who you are as a brand, also helps you build the right team. And it turns out that the number three reason why startups fail is because they have the wrong team.
So make sure to surround yourself with good friends. And by that, I mean trusted advisors.
Exactly. Trusted advisors and people who also believe what you believe. You know, Simon Sinek talks a lot about that. He said, you know, people who showed up for Martin Luther King's speech, they didn't show up for a plan.
In short, it's what you say, how you say it, and how that resonates with the one person you are trying to reach.
Well, and see, that's, you've really hit on something here, Liz, because I think a lot of people feel like somehow they're going to leave people out, you know, and I always get people who say to me, well, but what about these other people? And I said, well, you know what? Here's the thing. You can only do one thing, one great thing at a time. So do this one thing in a really great way. And guess what? People will come to you and say, you do this one thing really, really well. Would you be willing to do this other thing for me? Because what they love is your process, is how you think, right? So you show them that by doing one thing really well. And it seems a lot of times like it's counterintuitive, because I talk to founders all the time, and one of the things they always say to me, but this could be this, and it could be this, and we could solve this. And I say, yeah, that's true. But tell me the one thing that really you're passionate about. And usually it is only one thing.
It's interesting you say that, having just written a book. Both of us are speakers and writers. Your talk or your story can only be about one thing. There might be some subplots. There may be some secondary and tertiary characters, but they're really all in the background. They're not in the forefront, and they don't carry the story. So your business, your message can only be about one thing.
Yeah, and the truth is, I am really passionate about startups. You know, it's in my DNA. My father, generations of entrepreneurs and founders on my father's side, going back literally generations. And my mother's side is generations of educators. So I do both.
So it's in your DNA.
It's in my DNA. And I think for a lot of us, we feel, I don't know, maybe it's just me. Maybe it's our generation. I don't know. But I feel like, you know, I have finally sort of embraced this about myself. But this is really why I do this. You know, I mean, I've done work for corporations and I do workshops. I mean, I'm certainly capable and have been. I've done workshops for nonprofits, for large companies. It's not that I wouldn't do it, but what really makes me happy and what really motivates me is when I see that aha moment happen for someone who says, oh my God, that is what we do here.
This has been a trying year and a half, going on 2 years now. And I think there are a lot of people feeling a lack and an incredible sense of overwhelm about what can I do to amplify my business or to have better clarity about who I am. What is the one thing that somebody can do right now, the one action they can take in terms of sharpening their lean marketing? The real question is, what is the one small thing that somebody can do right now to put them on a different or better path with their brand, maybe a more effective path?
So one of the exercises, it's not in the book because I don't talk about personal brands, But the first step, and I do this with my LinkedIn clients, is I have them write a personal brand statement. And the process of putting that together helps you identify what you do, who you do it for, and what your unique, your UVP, your unique value proposition is. And people find that very helpful, because what happens is, once you get that level of clarity and it resonates. I mean, here's what happens. I'm not telling you what you should be. I'm just giving you the tools. And I'm saying to you, tell me if it, and then, you know, I help you, of course, translate it, synthesize it. I look at, you know, the answers, and I come back to you and say, this is what I'm hearing. Does this resonate with you? And if it does, then it's the right answer. It's not, you know, it's not some mathematical formula where, you know, but the reality is you already know the answer. It's just that I bring perspective and enough distance, because I'm not wedded to the outcome. So it's very easy for me to see it because I'm stepping back, right? So when I was doing my website, I didn't do it myself. I had to have someone else do it because you're too close. It's really hard, because the minute you put something in, you have to leave something out. And how do you know? How do you know what to leave in and what to take out? That's why you need to have this, you know, these exercises that are in the book are all around clarifying all of these things. But I would say putting together a personal brand statement is a really good first step, because the process of writing it helps you start to see, you know, really where you are, kind of, you know, where your passion is.
When you're developing a brand, many of us struggle with, what am I going to call myself? What am I going to do? You know, is what I do going to help or hurt my business? Will this be specific enough? Is it going to be polarizing? Will they know what I'm talking about? How important is it that you name yourself, and what's in a name?
So, of course, I have a whole chapter on identity in the book. And if you'll allow me, can I read a little something from the book to answer your question?
Absolutely, you may.
There it is. And I'll read this. So this was one of the founder stories, which is Nick Bayer from Saxby's. So he talks about, I thought a lot about the name before we opened our first cafe in 2005. I didn't want it to name it Nick's Cap Coffee because I didn't want it to be about me. I wanted to avoid cutesy names like Dancing Goat or Grind. I didn't want it to be about coffee because that's always been secondary to the human experience I wanted to create. Saxby's grew out of the letters from my aspirational brands, Saks Fifth Avenue, Tiffany's, Sotheby's, and Starbucks. The name was meant to be new and creative, but not over the top, and one that could be easily pronounced. What's interesting about this is the name is actually really critical. And I also tell people, you know, everybody knows, oh, I should get a logo. But they tend to jump into a logo before they really understand. Like, to me, logo is shorthand for your brand. And it's a way for people to quickly, you know, when you say Nike, you see the swoosh, right? But what people most people don't know what Nike's original name was, is that the original name was, first of all, it was called Blue Ribbon Sports.
What?
Yes, exactly. Every time I say that, people go, you've got to be kidding. They had that name for 10 years. And no one, I ask that question in almost every workshop that I do, every talk that I give, no one knows that name. And yet they did have it for 10 years. And what happened was, this is when you talk about the importance of a name, this is my answer. My answer is that while they had the name Blue Ribbon Sports, the company never went above, I think it was like maybe 10 to 15 million in terms of revenue. When they changed that name from Blue Ribbon Sports to Nike, which, by the way, that was the name of their iconic waffle shoe, which is what started the company. When they changed it to Nike, they almost overnight, they went from 10 to 100 million. And of course, they became a multi-billion dollar company, right? So now what they spend on marketing a year is 10 times more than what the company was valued at when they had that name. So the name is, you know, I mean, you think about Olympians, you know, standing on the podium. Can you imagine them, an Olympian, getting their gold medal over a shirt that says Blue Ribbon Sports? It just, it doesn't fit.
Well, your name is not usual, and it's been very helpful to you. When people first heard it, did they say, oh, what? So how did you make such an unusual name something into so positive?
It's actually in the book, in that same section. Yeah. So there's a lot of, you know, there's a combination of personal stories and then, of course, these wonderful founders who were just so gracious with their time and were just instrumental in really creating, I think, the kind of book I was hoping for, which is one that would give people hope and would show people, you know, kind of what not to do, but also what to do. So the chapter is called A Rose by Any Other Name. And the marketing myth is people buy our products in spite of our name. And then the whole chapter shows you how that's not true.
So to debunk branding and marketing myths and find out more about lean marketing, you can check out Ready Launch Brand by Orly Ziwi. It's on Routledge Press.
Yes, on Routledge, Taylor and Francis Group is the name of the publisher, and then also on Amazon.
Orly, thank you so much for coming out to play today. I really appreciate it. And of course, continued success with the book.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Liz. It's been a pleasure. I really enjoyed our conversation.
If you like what you hear, share this episode with a friend and please subscribe. You can get in touch with your story ideas at liz@embarkthepodcast.com. Next week, third Thursday of the month, we are back with Embark on Your Third Act. We'll be in studio with Michelle Fishburne, who just really landed on her butt at the beginning of the pandemic and came out with a lot of stories. We'll hear about her and her project, Who We Are Now. You won't want to miss it. In the meantime, I'm Liz Solar. Thanks for listening.